it starts to be this thing where he can start to imagine himself differently than how he is, but it's through the prism of basketball and the Knicks. So he's not going to put on a uniform and play basketball with me the way like a 7-year-old might or 5-year-old might. But he can in his mind kind of do that, and I can go with that. And instead of saying, let's focus on what's important here, which is your anxiety, here he's having an experience of not being anxious. When we're talking about the basketball, he's like fully alive and fully loose. And so the idea is that kind of therapy can actually be really helpful for people who are stuck.
You're listening to Conscious Mind.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. I am joined today by Dr. Ben Bernstein, who is a psychologist here at Silver Hill Hospital. Hello, Ben.
Hey, Molly. Great to be here.
I'm really excited to have Ben here today because not only is he super easy to talk to, but he's all about having fun and incorporating play into therapy with adolescents and adults and also with colleagues. So it's really a pleasure to have you here today. So let's start with that subject, because I think that's such a interesting and different topic that we haven't really touched on too much in this show, is play therapy. And just give me a little bit of a rundown on what it is and how you've used it and why it's important.
Of course. So first of all, thanks for having me on the show. Long-time listener, first-time guest. Play therapy is something that I learned in graduate school as a way to do therapy with young kids. Because if you have a young kid who's dealing with something, either something happened in their life, like, God forbid, they lost a parent, or it could be something that they're struggling with in school, like behavior. It doesn't work so well for anybody who has been around or has children, young children, to just try to say, well, why are you doing that? They don't know. Or to say, tell me about your childhood. Well, they're living their childhood, so they can't do that either. So play therapy becomes the kind of the language that they have to express the feelings that are going on inside of them and to receive comfort, to receive kind of guidance, and to feel connected to somebody else. So for really young people, it's kind of obvious that play therapy is, in my mind, the best modality, but certainly the one that makes the most sense. What I think is interesting is how do you take some of those same principles from play therapy, and I'll describe what play therapy looks like in a second, and bring them to adolescents and adults who can also really benefit from some of the underlying fundamentals.
I was going to ask that, because with kids, playing is what they do, right? It's their mode. They're often in that mode. And for adults, it's harder as we get into our careers and our lives, demands that we have. It's harder sometimes to break into that relaxed space where you can play and have fun. I would like to hear about how it works with kids and how it differs with adults.
Sure. So with kids, one of the ways that it works is that we walk into a room and there's toys and there could be costumes. It's a playroom. So imagine a playroom. And that kind of first principle would be to let the kid just sort of choose what they want to do and to sort of follow their lead. That's in like most situations. So a kid could pick up a doll or could pick up some Legos. And as a therapist, I'm kind of letting them lead and I'm following them. And I'm kind of supporting whatever choices they make. And it's a little bit scary as a therapist because you're not in total control. But the other side of it is it's really liberating and open and honest for the patient. And so you can go to places that you wouldn't have predicted to have gone. I'll give you a quick anecdote.
Yeah, definitely.
I was working with a kid who had gotten in trouble at school and then lied to his mom about it, meaning he got in trouble at school that day. His mom said, how did school go? He said, great. She said, did you get in trouble? He said, no. He was a 6-year-old boy, and he'd gotten in trouble at school a lot. So she gets an email from the teacher that says, actually, your son did get in trouble at school. Here's what happened. She wakes him up in the middle of the night and is like, how could you lie to me? Really freaks him out. She tells me about it a little bit later. He doesn't bring it up, but he starts having trouble sleeping at night. In therapy one day, he comes into the room and immediately starts constructing this, like, Lego setup. And there's a person on a bed in the Lego setup, and they keep getting woken up. And then he says, actually, Legos aren't a good enough way of doing this. I want to do this another way. So he has me pretend to go to sleep. and says, you're going to be sleeping. I say, okay. So I lay down and I pretend to go to sleep. And he comes up and just starts yelling and waking me up over and over again.
Wow.
And it's not clear from doing this. It's not like being like, okay, we're going to do these three steps. They're going to help you to sleep better. After that session, his sleep got way better, according to his mom.
So he needed to reenact something where he was maybe in control of the situation to, in order to heal from that experience.
Totally.
That's so interesting. And then with adults, how do you get adults to engage with this type of therapy without them, you know, looking at you like, oh, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm a grown up.
Right. Because if I asked almost any of my adult patients and even many of my adolescent patients to kind of play like that, they would just walk out or mm-hmm. they'd say, no, what are you talking about? I'm not a child. So a lot of what undergirds this theory comes from this psychiatrist and pediatrician named Donald Winnicott. I'm not going to get into all the boring theory of it, but he has this idea of something called transitional space. So the idea is that there's this way in which we're in when we're in reality, where everything is like what it looks like. And then there's like this sort of pure psychotic fantasy where like we're completely out of touch with reality. But then there's this idea that there's this third space where we're kind of like we're in fantasy life, but we know that we're in fantasy life. And so when we're playing as kids, that's what we're doing. And I'm going to answer your question, but I just want to get to this for a second.
No, I get that. I had a very active like imagination as a child, so I can put myself in that place.
So in this third space, in this transitional space, a kid could be in the middle of playing, let's say. Like I can talk about with my son. He'd be in the middle of playing with his toys and having them battle against each other. And my wife could say, dinner's in 5 minutes, and he could be saying like, hey, I'm gonna kill you. Yeah, you're gonna die. I'm gonna get you. This dinosaur's gonna eat you. Okay, mom, I'll be there in 5 minutes. Yeah, and then he can go right back into it because he can kind of navigate that. And so it's possible to get so there's this transitional space idea, this third space. So when I'm with adolescents and adults, a lot of my goal, without always knowing how I'm gonna do it, is how do I get us in our conversation into that space? And a lot of the way to do it is to think about things like fantasies, dreams, the what ifs. So sometimes I might even ask a question. Well, what would you do? Or what if that was the case? And by kind of activating imagination like that, people can go to places that they wouldn't have otherwise gone. Because a lot of times when people are stuck, it's because they're only stuck in that reality place.
Right. But they're still grounded in reality, but they're able to access that third space, as you say.
Totally. So as an example, I have a teenager who I work with where tons of anxiety and to the point where he would be like dry heaving before a big test, a lot of social anxiety as well. So when I first started working with him, I tried to attack the issue head on. I'm like, okay, well, let's think of some strategies here. Let's do some breathing techniques. Let's really think, is this test really the most important thing that you've ever had to do? You know, kind of much more cognitive approaches. And he was very compliant and he tried it, but it had basically no effect on his anxiety because mm-hmm. he would do it and it might help for a moment, but it wasn't getting it anything deeper. So I said, you know what, I'm going to just throw this whole playbook out. We'll just talk about whatever he wants to talk about. So he started talking about the Knicks, basketball. He loves basketball, loves the Knicks. And I'm enough of a basketball fan that I can kind of go along with it. And suddenly it gets to this point where I say, well, what would you do if you were, what would you if you were the coach of the Knicks? How would you have them play? What would your role be on the team? And he starts talking about, well, you know, I would be probably like a bench warmer. Well, but maybe I could be like a role player in this way. Or, and it starts to be this thing where he can start to imagine himself differently than how he is, but it's through the prism of basketball and the Knicks. So he's not going to put on a uniform and play basketball with me the way like a 7-year-old might or 5-year-old might. But he can in his mind kind of do that, and I can go with that. And instead of saying, let's focus on what's important here, which is your anxiety, here he's having an experience of not being anxious. Because right. when we're talking about the basketball, he's like fully alive and fully loose.
And there's like a degree of separation there that may help.
Totally, totally. And so the idea is that kind of therapy, which again, it doesn't look as kind of direct and it's not as direct as another approach, can actually be really helpful for people who are stuck because it gets them into that playing space. So he's imagining himself in all kinds of different ways than he would otherwise. And I'll say, in terms of symptom relief, in terms of him actually getting better, I'm not saying this is the only factor. I mean, the nice thing about working with adolescents and kids is that they develop naturally to some degree. But you know, he really experiences way less social anxiety about tests now. And I think part of that is because he's been able to kind of like play with me in this way in therapy.
Right. It's a really good tool in the toolkit. It may not be the be all end all of why he's gotten better, but it's something effective that's worked for him.
Totally.
So I, actually, while we're on the topic of sports, something I understand about you is you've written actually about the psychology of sports fandom, which to me feels very timely because football season is about to start. And I happen to sadly be a Jets fan, so I would love to understand, for my own selfish reasons, why this is, and why am I maybe a masochist in my fandom? But tell me more about this psychology of sports fandom.
Definitely, and I maybe need some help from you too, because one of my kids has decided to become a Jets fan.
Oh dear, and I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I like the uniforms; they're kind of cool.
Yeah.
So sports fandom kind of fits with this idea of play as well, which is to say, what are we doing when we're sports fans? It kind of comes down in some ways, if you want to I like to think of it, that song, We Are the Champions by Queen. It's not like they are the champions, but it's we, that we can kind of pretend that we're part of the team. And we can do that through dress up. People buy, you know, you see people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s and older wearing the same kind of costume, frankly, as like a, could be like a 19-year-old.
Right.
And we see it with people pretending to be those players, trying to learn the moves of those players.
Face paint.
Totally. And so we see all these different ways in which I think people actually are activating that same kind of young, playful self when they're sports fans. And that's actually really healthy. We see that, by the way, not just with humans, but with animals as well, that like being playful and playing is vital to, it's not just kind of a cool thing you do in therapy. It's actually how like people learn, how people have experiences communally all the time. So to me, sports fandom is a really healthy way to be playful like that. But there's some dangers to it too. So the positives are you can have these like really like play-based experiences that are really emotionally healthy, where you're rooting and rooting and rooting and being really invested, but also remembering at the same time that you aren't actually on the team, that you can have these feelings that are important feelings for all of us to have. Excitement, hope, disappointment, anger, frustration, but in this safe space of being a fan of this team. Where it gets dangerous is when people actually do kind of cross over to thinking that they really are so over-identified with the team. And you see this, you know, you see this to some degree in American sports, but you see it really, really, I think, profoundly in like European soccer, for example.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
Totally. And in South America, you see this too, where you have soccer fans essentially like beating each other sometimes to death because they're so identified with the team. So there are dangers. And you can see, by the way, the same thing with play. There's a Shakespeare line that I really like that's, I don't remember which play it's from, maybe Hamlet or Macbeth. One of those Shakespeare plays. It's violent. These violent delights have violent ends. And if you ever watch kids play, you can see that at first they're like play fighting, they're giggling, they're laughing, they're wrestling, and you can hear these squeals of joy. If you watch long enough, eventually it ends with like, what did you just do? And then you hear like a real punch, and then you hear
someone
like a
screaming.
Totally. Exactly. Right. So I think the same thing can happen with sports fandom, where people start off and it's like so delightful to
when
be a sports
fan. You
get
so excited. I think you're just like amped, right? So yeah. That can like open the door to other emotions.
Yeah. And then if those emotions get too intense and we kind of forget that we're in that transitional space and we go kind of fully into the fantasy world, you can see people get pretty aggressive and angry with each other.
It's like when people riot after, what was it, when the Red Sox won the series in 2004, I think.
I remember it well.
It was a wild, I mean, people are like burning property and flipping over cars. Like, what is that?
Yeah. So that's kind of like the dangerous part of that. But I think overall sports fandom is like really kind of healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great replacement also for kind of like, for war. I mean, if you think about it, like another place where we've seen that kind of like fantasy is like people rooting for sides in wars.
Mm-hmm.
But in some ways, sports have replaced that. But that's going to be a conversation for a different podcast.
Can it help with the loneliness, you know, building community and connection? And we talk a lot here at Silver Hill about loneliness and that it's really an epidemic and leads to a whole lot of negative experiences for people. Is being part of a sports team or rooting for a sports team something that you would say is protective from loneliness, even if you're not doing it with other people?
I think definitely. I would say it's greatly protective, and it helps people link and connect to each other in really important ways. And again, in kind of like mostly benign, non-dangerous ways.
Right.
Which is to say, like, you can also find a lot of companionship in cults, but those those don't usually end well. Unless.
So it's better to be a Jets fan than be run away with a cult, you're saying?
Yeah. If that's like the comfort that you can take from this, that's great.
Thank you. I do need some comfort. The season is coming, and there's always a buildup.
Are they going to be bad?
Oh, it's the Jets. Every year they're supposed to be good, and then they're horrible, and it's a letdown. So, we cope with it, and my whole family, we're a family of Jets fans. So it's, every year we know what to expect, but there's that glimmer of hope that it's going to be this season that they turn it around. And I think that's also something that kind of keeps you invested, is like the underdog factor, right? Like, you have a sports team that hasn't won the Super Bowl since the 60s, or even been to the Super Bowl, I don't think, since the 60s. There's that, like, how great will it be when they do win?
Yeah, and you've put in so much time and energy and effort in, like, following them and seeing yourself as part of this almost like family,
right?
Connected to
you
them.
Identify. Yeah.
And that identification, I think, again, is kind of good in a certain amount of,
even if they lose even if they're constantly letting you down,
because then you're losing with other people, then there's a sense that you and your family can kind of like cope together.
Yes. And as Larry David said, the Jets are such a disappointment, and it's so true. But we love them. They're our Jets, so they're our disappointment. So when we're speaking about loneliness, there's also the concept of imposter syndrome and quote unquote feeling real. Can you talk to me a bit about this and the concept of authenticity? Because actually it does also tie into sports fandom, in the sense that, like, I've decided that part of my identity is going to be a Jets fan, right? And is that authentic? Is that something that is me, or that's just something I chose and it's this like facade? And I think authenticity is just such an interesting concept. So talk to me about that.
It sounds like it's you. I mean, when you were talking about it a moment ago, it sounded like you were really passionate about it, and it's been part of your connection to your family and your connection to friends and community. So that sounds pretty real to me.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, exactly. I guess the reason why I would say there's a connection here between the loneliness piece and this imposter syndrome stuff that I like to talk about is that a lot of times, first of all, imposter syndrome has like taken off as this phrase. If you look at like the Google searches for the last 20 years, it goes from basically not being mentioned to being very mentioned and very searched and very important. And there's lots of books about it.
How would you sum it up for those who may not have ever heard of this term? How would you sum up imposter syndrome?
Yeah, I think imposter syndrome is, I would define imposter syndrome as the feeling of fear that you're going to be found out for not being good or adequate at the thing that other people think you're good or adequate at.
Wait, that happens to me all the time. Does that happen to everybody?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Well, except for people who are either A, like kind of a little delusional about how good they are at something, or B, people who are really good at the thing. So, sometimes when people have these imposter feelings, it's because they actually are getting used to a new role. It'd be kind of like insane to not feel insecure about that.
Right.
So, like, one way to never feel imposter syndrome is to always stay in non-challenging situations. Like, if I were to say, like, okay, Molly, I'd like you to go back to do the job that you were really good at, like, 4 jobs ago, I bet you could do it without feeling like an imposter so much. Because you would just dominate.
It's familiar. I know I can do it.
Nobody's going to, and you wouldn't be thinking that anybody would like find you out, because if they found you out, they just found, oh, she's as good as she looks at this thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So part of what happens is in a world where we're trying to get better and try new things is we're going to have feelings of inadequacy when we start those things. What really makes this, I think, this is not a real like sort of diagnostic syndrome, but what makes these kind of feelings so prevalent and so powerful have to do with connection. Because if we're in a really trusting environment, we're not worried about being found out. Because, like, if somebody you trust and love found or cared about and they cared about you found out that you found out, I'm putting air quotes around that you weren't as good as it appeared, they wouldn't care. They would
right.
try to be
if
supportive.
If you didn't know something, they would try to help you, or they would just totally. Understand.
Totally. So I think a lot of what happens when I have had patients who talk about these imposter feelings, a lot of the times it is connected to feeling lonely in some way. And when I say lonely, it might be at work. It might be that they're in a workplace where there's no trust.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're always worried they're going to be found out, because if they were found out, their coworkers or their boss would like come down really hard on them.
Right.
Whereas if they're in a place where there's a kind of a growth mindset to the whole workplace or whatever the form is for this person's feelings, it's not such a big deal. It's like, oh yeah, if I make mistakes, that's fine, because this person will teach me, or my people around me will help support me.
Right. We can grow and learn together. I feel like that's such an important concept to foster in a workplace. How do you build that into the culture of a workplace where it's okay to be okay at things, or you're really good at some things and maybe not so great at other things, but it's not something you're trying to hide or something you're trying to pretend to be that you're not. I wonder how you can actually like cultivate that.
I think there's like three ways that I would suggest. The first is that it has to come as a message from leadership, and it has to be a message from leadership that's not just spoken about, but that's enacted as well, that leadership makes mistakes and then owns up to them. The second thing is that people have to be able to make mistakes, and then their coworkers or bosses have to not come down so hard on them, but to see them as okay. And one way that can happen is by giving people actually excuses, which sounds kind of counterintuitive. Like usually it would be like, no excuses, like work harder. But if you create and foster a place where when people are making mistakes because they took risks at trying to develop their skills, mm-hmm. and they messed up and there's no huge penalty for that, that's going to cultivate more growth and more risk-taking in a positive way. And then the third thing, I think, which is, again, kind of like – it's almost like coming at it from a side angle, is building up more trust between coworkers just in general.
Mm-hmm.
Just how do you make it so that people feel more at home with each other and more connected to each other, like outside of them working on some specific task? So companies where that exists, workplaces where that exists, communities where that exists, I think people feel – less like the fraud. They feel less like they're going to be found out.
Right. And they're probably happier.
I would assume so. Yeah.
Right. They can also play with each other. They can be relaxed around each other. And I know that you and some of the other leaders at the hospital have been working on getting more people together, colleagues together to do fun things like play Pictionary and arrange flowers and all sorts of like activities kind of outside of the norm of just sitting at your desk and working with patients. And I feel like that's really key to this connection piece.
Yeah. And not just colleagues. I mean, even at the hospital, one thing that, I mean, you've been part of this as well, is we have a creative expression kind of open mic hour once a week, which has been one of the most powerful experiences I've had at the hospital.
Awesome.
Being able to be part of that. And it's crazy because I went and I played a song at the open mic part. And some of the patients did too. And then I was running a therapy group later that week. It was a really profound group. I mean, people shared stuff they hadn't shared. There were tears. There was laughter. It was like an amazing experience. And I think part of that was because we had been in this kind of trust-building space earlier that week.
And vulnerable space. You know, performing music in front of a group of people that you don't know and all of the feelings that come with something like that. You were able to, as their group leader and their psychologist, able to show a side of yourself that maybe they wouldn't have ever seen if this group didn't exist.
Right. And it came about a little more organically than if I had started the group off by saying, okay, everybody, today I'm going to tell you my biggest fear. That would have been kind of like going back to the earlier thing about kids in play therapy. I think part of my principle is I want to let the patients lead. And by creating that creative expression space, it wasn't artificial for me to share something about myself or some talent or maybe lack of talent, but somewhere in the middle. But
you're talented.
Yeah, go on.
I was there. Yeah, go on. Tell me more about that. That was great. And it was the willingness of people to just stand up and do anything, something. I was astounded by it, and it was really fantastic. Something great that's come out of that group also is we've had some patients and residents come to the radio station and record music in here where we're sitting right now and have really become part of our little extended Silver Hill radio community. So I think, you know, to talk about identity, belonging, community, the more that we can build these things within the structure that we have here at the hospital, the better we'll be for it, for us, for our patients, and the Silver Hill community at large. So you being here today and spending time talking to me has been a real pleasure. It's been fun. I feel like I spent a half an hour playing today and being able to kind of get out of that mindset that we sit in so many hours of our day and our week. So thank you, Dr. Bernstein.
It's been a pleasure for me. And I think a kind of risk for me that I can take by being here and sharing some of this stuff. And I wouldn't be able to do that if I didn't already have this kind of connection with you from being a colleague. So yeah, it kind of this whole thing in action.
Came together really nicely.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Conscious Mind on Silver Hill Radio.
No, don't worry. I can cut all this stuff out.
Okay.